TFM.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, just a word of advice before we get started. Don't take a chief's tools without asking.
You know what? I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to. I just needed to get in real quick and get out. And I didn't think that he would mind.
I love when O'Brien says that because we know him as Chief on the Enterprise D and then here on Deep Space Nine. But the way he says it is like, there's a chief everywhere, which there probably are, but we just don't normally hear about them. And he's just like, you never take a chief's tools without asking.
I mean, and what about all those kids, you know, whose dad just calls them chief? You know, it's like, do you take their tools? Is that also a part of this? You know, so anyway, bad dad joke.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are going to continue our 30th anniversary rewatch of Deep Space Nine today with the final episode of season one, In the Hands of the Prophets. And here is a quick rundown of this story. When Keiko O'Brien decides to teach the children aboard Deep Space Nine about the Bajoran wormhole, she takes a scientific approach. Word soon reaches the planet, and Vedic Wynn is having none of it. The religious leader sees Federation influence and its secular teachings as a threat to her people's beliefs. Seeing a chance to exert influence on the station and advance her own standing in the upcoming selection of a new Kai, she hatches a plan to assassinate a fellow Vedic and turn the tide of opinion against the Federation. So, Matthew, that is really the heart of the story. It reflects what was going on in the real world at the time, I mean, and before and after today as well, but especially at the time this was written. It was a topic that was very much at the forefront of American society. But within the Star Trek universe, it's a wonderful bookend to what was set up in Emissary with Sisko coming as the emissary of the prophets and how the arrival not only of the Federation but of Sisko would be viewed by Bajorans, particularly people like Wynn, who we meet for the first time in this episode, who has a very orthodox view of the Bajoran faith. And here at the end of the season, we bring that all back around and I think really start to set up the DS9 story. So what are your first thoughts on this episode?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things that, you know, I think we've talked about many a times on this show, and we've even talked about this episode before, but the way in which this really is the catalyst for everything that Deep Space Nine will become, you know, I think this is one of the, you know, you think about the run up to this episode and you like had Duet and then you get this episode. The end of the season really has some hard hitting episodes with some really big themes that kind of really only could come in this series as it's set up with the characters you get with like the Bajorans, the Cardassians, even the Federation. And it almost seems as though here by the end of the first season, they have kind of zeroed in on the fact that by creating the Bajoran race, the Cardassians, and bringing the Federation all together, there's this nice trinity of elements which really play off each other and really allow us to play with a lot of different real-world type of thematic elements but through the lens of Deep Space Nine. And all of these elements, too, as we've mentioned many times, are kind of more universal. They're more mythic. They're more things to which we have seen throughout history. So it doesn't feel so, you know, pigeonholed into just one era. I think if anything, you know, if we had maybe any big frustration with, say, modern Star Trek that we've seen after mm-hmm. Enterprise, it's been that it's so encumbered with this idea of that we have to be of the moment in a mm-hmm. way that makes it only of that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, having just rewatched most of TOS with my wife and now starting the Next Generation, it's the first time she's ever seen that. We've already watched Enterprise. And even just watching the ways in which those shows, they dealt with hot topic issues of their time, mm-hmm. but did it in a way that as I'm watching it now, I can kind of see the ways in which it's still a valid thought process. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the end of the first season of Deep Space Nine really sets this show on a course to say, we're going to kind of continue that. The same type of storytelling that you got in the original series, the same type of storytelling that was the best of The Next Generation, we're going to continue that here. And in fact, that's actually going to become Deep Space Nine's calling card, right? Mm-hmm. You know, one could say it was in the cards for them to do this. And so to have this clash of worldviews between mm-hmm. science and religion hit here to kind of bring those worlds together of what happens when you put a very religious people and people who have a strictly religious worldview next to a very secular, materialistic worldview. And materialistic, I don't mean in the sense by that we're worried about gathering more things. The materialist worldview is that the matter in which we see that makes up the universe is all that is. There is nothing mm-hmm. beyond that. Those two worldviews coming together, and they collide, and it creates one of Deep Space Nine's most memorable episodes.
Mm-hmm. So that conflict of worldviews that's put on display here, it's interesting to me in many ways. One way that is interesting is that, just talking about, like you said, a general view of at least Starfleet would be that the world that we see, all the material around us, that's all there is. The Bajorans are scientifically, I would believe, because culturally, they're far more advanced. They're about 800 years mm-hmm. ahead of humans in reality. It just doesn't look like it when you look at the planet as it's right. shown yeah. to us at this point.
Well,
right?
And after 50 years of occupation, you know, so mm-hmm. much of what they had was completely destroyed. So
sure, yeah. right. But in terms of their understanding of nature and the universe and science, and they built spaceships long before humans, you know, had electricity even, you would expect that they would have the scientific understanding of what a wormhole is and how that would function in nature. And so in contrast to situations we've seen maybe in the original series or The Next Generation, where the Federation is dealing with a world and a culture that lacks that knowledge and things seem supernatural to them, that wouldn't be the case here. So the Bajorans have, and I shouldn't even say the Bajorans because we're painting with a broad brush there of like all the people on Bajor, right? The Bajorans that we interact with, like Wynn here, Burrell, Kira to some extent, Opaka before, they're taking, they're letting us see the world through their eyes as believers in the Bajoran faith. So I guess where I'm going with this is that the setup of a conflict here, it's a bit more complicated than just the simple science versus religion, it plays into the idea of why Starfleet and the Federation are here at Bajor in the first place, which Sisko kind of touches on towards the end of the episode when he says that, you know, protecting your borders isn't really the primary reason we're here in the first place. Right. We're here to build a relationship with you. And it, at the beginning of Emissary, he's charged with the mission by Picard to make sure the Bajorans are prepared to become members of the Federation. So the Federation, while Wynn paints the Federation here as being evil, she says you live in a universe of darkness and you would drag us in there with you. While the Federation seems open to the idea of a world, a culture with values that seem on the surface to be very different from theirs, being part of their group, being part of the Federation. And Sisko even says it's his philosophy that there's room for all philosophies on the station. So to frame all of that as a question back to you to see how you think about it, does this seem truly like a situation of a conflict between cultures and worldviews, or one person in Wynn using the situation for her own personal gain, despite the fact that Sisko and the Federation seem to be open to the diversity of thought in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the episode really sets up Wynn as being somebody who is, I mean, first and foremost, Wynn is utilizing religion as a way to gain power.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost even, I mean, this is the first time we meet her. We'll talk about her more fully in a little bit. But in the end, you could already tell that this is a character who doesn't truly believe any of this. She's just mm-hmm. using it as a way to gain power. And I think the reason that this is the case and the reason you can see that is the way that she immediately bifurcates between the Federation and Bajorans, and that there's no in between. That science and religion are mutually exclusive, you know. And I think that's one of the biggest things about this episode is that, you know, even we see Kira and even some others being almost willing to that are Bajorans be willing mm-hmm. to kind of fall into this false dichotomy as if science and religion have to be at odds with one another, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I thought that Kira fell into that too easily.
Yes, and I thought so too. And I think part of that is the writers having that last moment for Kira of really mm-hmm. That this is going to be her last hurdle to truly mm-hmm. kind of, because by the end of the season, she's really kind of bought into this relationship. She's created a good relationship with Sisko. And mm-hmm. I think this becomes that last hurdle. And because I think Kira becomes a person who can kind of see through what Wynn's doing by the end.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore she realizes that basically she's been played, you know, her religion has been played against her in a way that actually makes no sense, because these two don't have to be mutually exclusive. We make mm-hmm. them mutually exclusive for no good reason, you know, as somebody who is a person of extreme.
To separate people into tribes that we can have power ourselves.
But, you know, as a person of faith, I don't believe at all that science and religion are on opposite sides, right? I believe that all truth is God's truth, and therefore whatever we find out about the universe helps us understand what has been created better, right? We have science mm-hmm. for a reason, because there is order and we can discover what has orderly been created, you know? And mm-hmm. so that's something that I think the episode, you know, the character of Brielle then becomes that voice of reason to say, science just helps us understand what the prophets have done. It doesn't mean mm-hmm. take anything away from them, but it allows us to understand better either. And we never actually truly kind of get into whether the prophets are responsible for creation in the Bajoran religion, that type mm-hmm. of stuff. But there's a way in which I think Belial becomes the avatar of reason. And again, that idea that, hey, these two can not only coexist, but they can actually work together to strengthen one another. Science doesn't have to negate our faith. In fact, it can strengthen our faith, you know? And so, and of course, too, the difference between them as well is that, you know, for Wynne, she puts science against religion as if one should defeat the other, or one could defeat the other, you know? And Belial is basically the type of person is like, well, if my faith can be defeated by science, then maybe it's in the wrong thing, kind of. And so I love the nuance that's going on in this episode, because I think the base conflict between Wynne and O'Brien are actually the most partisan versions of this argument. And then everybody else kind of fills in the middle of this argument, which is, as we get closer to the middle, is actually where we all should be able to be.
Yeah.
So that's the thing I think I really love about this whole conflict, because they're not really at odds unless we make them at odds. And it's kind of like I don't think, you know, schools should necessarily teach religion, but I don't think that they should negate the fact that religion exists and people might believe things. So, yeah, this is what makes this episode so great, is it allows us to have really important conversations about things of our own world, you know, and that's one of the things that people have always loved about Star Trek the most.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that nuance is where I think this episode in particular sets DS9 on the course to become the series that we know and love, because to this point in Star Trek, religion has typically been, we've talked about this many times on here, I think, presented as a bad thing.
Right, exactly.
Our captains, our crews fly around the galaxy, and when they encounter a culture that has religion, especially one that seems guided by religion, it's like they're on a mission to set them right and show them, well, you know, that's a false thing. You need to look at the real world around you,
right,
and get rid of this religion thing that you're hanging on to. And as anyone who listens to our podcasts knows, I'm not religious. But I don't think you should negate someone's faith either. So Star Trek had been very black and white on these issues for a long time. And then we get here to this story, which it's been building to this. But when we get here, it's stated so clearly that, and I think it's so effective because it's being delivered through the words of a Starfleet commander. And not only a Starfleet commander, but someone who's been put in what at this point in time is a very awkward position for him as being viewed as a religious figure on another world. So he internally is torn between the science and religion that he has grown up with, that he's learned. But he's presenting a very open view, I feel. The quote I mentioned earlier, my philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station. He tries to find a solution. He tries to be open-minded and flexible. And Wynne digs in more and more and more. And in doing so, of course, she exposes who she really is, that she's really in this for her. And by the end, Sisko explains what you said earlier as well, that we should be able to meet in the middle. We should be able to talk to each other. He said that after she says that the Federation exists in the universe of darkness, the quote that I mentioned earlier. And Sisko pushes back and says, look, you know, the people that live here, they know that we're neither enemy nor the devil. We don't always agree. We have some damn good fights, in fact, but we always come away from them with a little better understanding and appreciation of each other. And that is a point where I feel like the Star Trek that I loved all the way up to this point finally became well-rounded. It finally became a true vehicle for talking about society, the way society truly functions. Yeah. And it's kind of unexpected in Star Trek to get to this point.
Yeah, you know, I think one of that quote from Sisko is one of those quotes that the more I've thought about, the more I think sounds so naive, which is not Which all quote? Philosophies are valid, right? Like, shouldn't be room for all philosophies on the station because there are certain philosophies.
There are bad philosophies. You know,
we would, across the board, most people would say, unless you're an adherent to one of those, which you're in the ultra minority, is terrible, right? So, you know, right. I think.
But I don't think that was the intention of what he was saying.
It's not the intention. It's just one of those things where it's like, those type of blanket statements, I think we all have to be very careful of because, there is, again, that's a place almost where there's a lack of nuance, that this episode is trying to drive at. And so it's just one of those places where, as I think about the episode more, I'm like, okay, I would probably rewrite that to say almost all philosophies, you just give a little caveat in there, you know?
Okay. I'm going to just throw one thing in real quick because again, I know that's not, you know, he didn't intend that every single philosophy, no matter how wretched and extreme it might be, but different cultures, different ideologies, different worldviews or just societal structures within Star Trek could be very diverse. So I'm just thinking, if this episode were written today, I think one element of Star Trek that we know of, it's not explained at this point in Star Trek, but if we just look at what we do now know about Andorians and Andorians having four genders, right?
Or at least in the book series, yes.
In the book series, right? Yeah. But if they were to bring that in for you and me, I think, you know, the books all play into the whole of Star Trek.
So sure.
That's something that it's a perfectly valid social structure for the Andorians. And that's how their society functions. That's how their biology functions. Sure. And I don't think that anyone from the outside should tell them otherwise. Mm-hmm. And the Andorians are members of the Federation. Right. So you could have a DS9 situation here where you have Andorians living on the station you have to accept that, which is something that would seem unusual to humans and I think to Bajorans as well. So so I think there is a very diverse set of philosophies in Star Trek that you would have to grapple with in the real world if you were living in this
time. Yeah, absolutely. No, I 100% agree with you. And two, you know, I think that's where I think the actual conceit of Star Trek that, you know, you would have all of these different alien races that have these different ways of being, right? That are alien and literally alien to what any other species would consider quote unquote normal because that's the way it works. And so, I think that's the thing that is that it makes this really interesting. And that, again, kind of becomes the thing in a lot of ways, as you're kind of mentioning, that Deep Space Nine is going to try to get us to, is to find a way to bridge the gulf between us. And, I couldn't agree more with the fact that, you know, I think we've talked about many times on the show that Deep Space Nine finally decided to tackle a part of life that it had, that Star Trek had basically, for the most part, not completely. I think the original series was a little more forgiving to religion because you know, I mean, there was a chapel on board the Enterprise, and, you know, yeah. And
I think they had to do that at that time. Well, I think it was natural to do it at that time.
Possible, but I mean,
on TV.
I think even the character of McCoy is always portrayed as somebody who maybe still loosely has a Judeo-Christian kind of belief system to him. Yeah. And even Kirk in some ways, you know, but at the same time, right, they're open to everything. And so when they're going against false gods, that's their thing. It's like a false god. It's a computer program or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So
seeing a slogan for the Enterprise, going against false gods. Yeah. That's our theme.
Yeah. Destroying false gods one planet at a time.
They got a t-shirt. They got a bumper sticker on the left nacelle.
Right? Exactly. and then I think it became a little bit more pronounced, that kind of worldview in the Next Generation, where, yes, you know, you went to a planet and they were worshiping something. The planet people were always kind of seen as like, oh, aren't you cute? And then Deep Space Nine comes along and yeah, no, we're going to treat these as legitimate beings who have a real reason for believing what they believe. And their thought process is just as valid as our thought process. And in fact, maybe if we put both of the thought processes together, we might have an even fuller understanding. And that's what this episode really kind of is all about.
Well, let's talk a little bit more, if we have more to say, about the two new characters that are introduced in this episode, Wynn and Beryl, because they become an important part of the story. What I find very interesting about Wynn is that this is the first time that we meet her, but she comes in, Louise Fletcher brings this presence to this character from the moment she arrives that you feel like she's been part of the story, even though she hasn't. And especially when you know where her character goes, watching the performance in this episode, I know that Louise Fletcher didn't know where the character was going to go, really, but she certainly seems to have understood the assignment.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on that. You know, I think one of the things that's really incredible about her portrayal and just her as a character, this is the most interesting thing, if you ask me. What happens with her as a character? She comes in just like Garak does. And you're like, oh, I feel like this character's been here the whole time. They haven't, but you feel like that. And that is, I think that's one of the things here in this episode that I think really sets the writing of Deep Space Nine apart already, is that these characters are coming into this episode and feel so intrinsic and like just natural to the storytelling. You do get this sense of like, did I miss an episode? Was this character on an episode and I just missed it? You know? And I think that's what's so great about her. And as we've talked about, you know, the fact that we've set up this tension between Bajor and the Federation like this, between Sisko specifically and Wynn, I mean, we're really setting up something that we know, of course, now plays into the entire rest of the series, right? And they don't know that right now, you know, they have no clue, you know, they're just trying to finish off this season, and make it a banger. Right. And so
I thought they were trying to make it a winner.
Look at you and your dad jokes. fantastic. That was a really good one. So, and yet, as we've talked about so many times on the show, one of the things that they do is they write great stories which lend themselves to basically being their own breadcrumbs for further stories. And that's great writing. And I think part of that, you know, is a lot of these guys had kind of come from the Next Generation. And even, I know it's not really true because it's not really until the second season where they fully start to embrace the idea of continuity as it's going to be known in Deep Space Nine, because of course they start off with the trilogy of episodes. But it's almost like by the end of the season here, they're already starting to get to that place. And Wynn becomes a character to which it almost seems like they're planting the seeds because they know they want to continue to do more with this character and with this kind of subject matter. And then, of course, that's what opens season two. And so, yes, she just becomes an incredible addition to the cast. And then Louise Fletcher is just, I mean, she is so despicably delicious as a character. She is sinking her teeth into every single moment that she's in and really playing it so well. Oh my goodness. I mean, you couldn't have asked for a better actress to come in and play this role and then have to be able to return for many, many more seasons and many more episodes.
Yeah. It's easy to say this when you're used to an actor playing a particular character for a long time. But in this case, I do feel like this may not have worked as well as it did with a different actress.
Yeah, agree.
Like, you could tell the story and you could get the point across, but there's something about the way she delivers all of this and how she interacts with Keiko and Sisko that it feels so real. It like sucks you in and it goes beyond the actual situation, just the story that they're trying to tell. And it pulls you in to this mind that, I know, this like cold, calculating mind it's incredible. And then Beryl offers kind of a counterpoint within the religion of someone who, to me, feels more familiar, you know, living in Japan and having been part of a family that has a 1,300-year-old temple in the family, and having been around monks, and he's more familiar to me of what I expect from the way they try to portray the Bajorans in general, whereas Wynn is kind of outside of that, just using it for her own ends, right?
Well, and I think, you know, one of the ways in which, like you just mentioned, the beauty of Beryl is that he becomes the antithesis to Wynn, but he helps us immediately understand at the end of this first season, and we've seen this, you know, through Kira a little bit, but what he's saying to all of us, we are not going to be a monoculture for the Bajorans. We are going to create a dynamic culture, one that allows us to really feel like this is a society that's alive, and just the same way that we would have with our Starfleet characters, right? And I also think, too, and maybe we've never talked about this, and this just came to me, but I do think one of the beauties of Deep Space Nine is that it creates a less of a monoculture for even Starfleet, is that there are Starfleet officers, and this is what we see with Sisko, right? Again, we kind of talked about the beginning, this idea of this materialist worldview against this spiritual worldview, and has, you know, that they're at odds with one another. And yet, Sisko will become the one who helps broaden the view of the Federation to the fact that maybe the spiritual and the material aren't that far apart. Maybe there's more to both sides than just only thinking there's one side. And I think that's the thing that I really love. And Beryl then becomes the avatar for that for the Bajorans. Right. And then you have that dual role there with Sisko, in the sense that he's beginning to play that role for the Federation, that we're going to allow the Starfleet mind to kind of be cracked open to say, hey, maybe there is something to this that we haven't given enough credence to. Maybe actually we've been the ones who have been a little blind to the idea that there's more to this universe than just what we can scan on a tricorder.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's why the setting of DS9 works so well, even though it was criticized early on as being stationary.
Yes. Yep.
Because you can only do this by getting these Starfleet officers off of a starship.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
What we've done with this show is we've pulled them out of that structured military setting.
Yep.
Where they're in this chain of command. They're on an assignment on a starship that's owned by Starfleet. And you've put them into a little city. You've put them into a community where they have a bit. Of course, they have their duty shifts and they're still enlisted in Starfleet. But they've got a commander, like you said, who is a bit more relaxed than a starship commander typically would be. And they're also in a setting where they have an opportunity to kind of live a life that's a little bit more like a life that would be lived by ordinary people instead of you being on duty all the time on a starship. Now, I know they did yoga and stuff on the Enterprise D, but still, it was a very structured, line of command there. And I think that having this space station setting opened the door to Star Trek to be able to expand its worldview in the first place. And it never would have happened if we had gone right into another series with another starship.
No, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think, like you mentioned, one of the beauties of that, and it becomes, if you want kind of a overall picture of that in just one character, Sisko's dual role of Starfleet captain and emissary of the prophets really, I think, sets the stage for that. And the fact that, this isn't just a thing that we set up at the beginning of the season and then we never touched on again. We keep bringing it up throughout this season, and we end here in a place that kind of sets him in the middle of both of these worlds and having to find a way to kind of bridge the gap. Sisko, in many ways, is kind of this Bajoran Jesus, that's really what he's going to be for them.
That's not where the expression Bajesus comes from, is it?
Maybe.
Like, I've heard people say that, but...
But that's exactly, like you were saying, that's where, Deep Space Nine being in a stationary place where people come to it and where you have the influence of the Bajoran influence, the Cardassian influence, the Federation influence, and then we're going to get things from the Gamma Quadrant as an influence. We're going to have the influence of the entire Alpha and Beta Quadrants coming together throughout this series. I mean, that's what we're building to, and that's what this episode really gives us. Like you said, Sisko's a different type of captain. He's kind of uptight about some things, but in a lot of ways, he's like a captain who plays jazz, right? Literally and figuratively, because he has that kind of looser style. He's willing to kind of roll with the drums, He might be playing the trumpet and the drums do one thing and now the trumpet has to do the next, and he knows how to do that in a way that a lot of our other captains don't necessarily. And in fact, maybe the closest captain to him, and this is where in some ways I think he harkens back to the a captain that came before him and a captain that comes after him in the sense that he has some Kirkness to him where he's kind of rolling with the punches. The same thing kind of with Archer, where he's kind of like literally having to make this up as he goes along because nobody's been in this situation as a captain before. Mm-hmm. And that becomes the central kind of premise of the series in many ways of trying to bridge these two worlds.
Yeah. And the Strange New Worlds, Anson Mount Pike, has a lot of Sisko in him, I think.
I think you're right. Yeah. It is interesting you bring that up because I think the Anson Mount Pike feels almost like the most Sisko of any of the other captains because He enjoys good music. He enjoys cooking, which mm-hmm. is very Sisko. He enjoys that being close to his crew mm-hmm. and really getting to know them as people by having them over for dinner. And he enjoys a good drink, a good whiskey, you know, which we mm-hmm. see many times. So, yeah, that's a really interesting pull that I hadn't thought of before. Maybe that's one mm-hmm. of the reasons that I've always really enjoyed the Pike character in that show because of the way he's written. Because in all, I think he just feels very human.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what it is. He feels incredibly human. And Sisko, in the end, by being placed in this role where he's having to try and figure it out, but on top of that being the father figure, which he has to be in this episode too, right? Because he has to worry about his own son. You know, mm-hmm. his son is in danger with these attacks happening right. against yep. the school. Yep. And so you see all of these things at play, and it makes us relate to him because all the fans, so many of the fans at this point watching this show, that have grown up with Star Trek, now they've got families of their own. And these are all the types of questions they're having to think about. They're having to think about how are they going to raise their kids religiously? How are they going to raise their kids educationally? You know, how are they going to conduct themselves in a world when it comes to the different political factions they might want to support or not support? I mean, like, all mm-hmm. of that is such a representation of where we are in the modern world. And when I say that, I mean, you know, from when Star Trek first started in the 60s all the way to where we are now, right? And that's one of the things we've always loved about Deep Space Nine, is that it represents every time period that you're watching it in. And I think, you know, one of the things that we've talked about many times, and something that you had kind of mentioned on the outline, is like that the real Deep Space Nine stands up by the end of this season.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
and even this is the thing, right? We're at the end of the season. We finally reached the end. I know you've all been waiting for it. We finally got here. We're sorry it took that long. The beauty, though, is that by the end of the first season of Deep Space Nine, the show already finally feels like it knows what it is, mm-hmm. which yeah. I don't think that you could say about The Next Generation. It didn't quite know what it wanted to be until almost the end of the second season and yeah, into right. the third. Yep.
Into the third, yeah.
But this, because we're doing the retrospective, we know what's coming in the second season. And so by the last three or four episodes of the first season, moving into the second season, we've been building to where we're going. Mm-hmm. And I think that's that's pretty incredible, you know, that they got here.
Well, those sound like final thoughts, Matthew. So what's your rating for this one?
You know, we didn't even talk about the wonderful humor between the O'Briens and their marriage and her ribbing him a little bit about Neela, you know, being a beautiful young woman that he's working with. Yeah. And she's like, just keeping you on your toes, O'Brien. And it's just so... like that, you know, that's classic marriage, right?
Yeah, but she's insightful because later on there is a scene
there
where
is.
Neela is kind of, and Miles recognizes it and like, you can just go.
Yes. So I think
Keiko's more insightful than it might seem at the beginning where it seems like that's
great.
Just a joke.
No, right? And the beauty is that, you know, O'Brien has just kind of been denying it in some ways, you know, because that's not who O'Brien is, right? He's not here to play the field, right? He's dedicated to his family, and that's one of the things we all love in him. But all that to say is that that's a part of the episode we didn't even talk about, but it's so mm-hmm. wonderful. All in all, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, this is a banger. This is a winner. This is a straight 5 for 5 failed assassination attempts. So great. I mean, Chris, this is just a fantastic episode. And the thing that it does is that it makes you so looking forward to, so excited to dive in then to season two. And that's exactly what you want when you finish a season. So this is fantastic. What about you? What would you rate In the Hands of the Prophets?
Well, you just once again said that it's a banger. And earlier when you said that, I said it's a winner for Vedic Win. I assume here you're referring to Vedic Barayal, who later becomes Vedic Bang.
Sure. Yes. That's yes.
So I think this is a fantastic episode. I watched it again last night. It's been a while since I've seen it, and I just finished it and just said to myself, wow, it's amazing. It's of course it could be refined. There are elements of the writing and the storytelling that maybe lack nuance, but it's just so good where they're taking Star Trek here and how they're giving a more rounded view of the world. And I love the line that Sisko says to Jake when he says that it may not be what you believe, but that doesn't make it wrong. If you start to think that way, you'll be acting just like Vedic Wynn, only from the other side. And I feel in today's world, especially, that's just something that people need to keep in mind. That I'm not saying that everything is right. I'm not saying that every view or attitude is valid, because there are some extreme ones. But I think what we fight with each other over these days is stuff that we should be able to just talk to each other about and accept that we're not all going to agree. We're not all going to see everything the same way. But in the end, you know, we're together as a community. And I think it's a good message that holds up very well. And I also think that it's nice in this episode how they work other elements in. We even get an Odo murder mystery running through the episode. And so as DS9 does so well, it's not a one-note story. It's not just about the science versus religion with the wormhole. It's not just about the power struggle between Vedic Wynn and Vedic Barayal. But you've got this other thing running through it, with Odo doing what he does and playing a very important role in preventing the assassination of Barayal, even though he's very much on the outside of all of it, the science versus the religion, the Bajoran struggle for Kai, all that. He's on the outside, but he's able to solve it with his sleuthing. So I'm going to give this episode 10 damn good fights.
Nice. That's fantastic.
All right, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on In the Hands of the Prophets. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. If you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post on the timeline for this episode, and you can share comments with your fellow listeners and Matthew and me right there on that timeline. If you'd like to send us email, you can do that by going to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show. Choose the orb, and that will come to Matthew and me right through the wormhole, regardless of whether it was constructed by entities or however it got there. It's stable. We'll get the message. And also, you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not dressing up to help Quark fill his shortage of Dabo girls, where can people find you?
Wow. All I could say is nobody will be at Quark's if that happens. But you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. Of course, here on the network, outside of all the Star Trek talk that we do in the 602 Club, talking about all of those franchises that we love. So please join us there. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network, a completed show called Owl Post with Drea Kaufman about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, as well as Aggressive Negotiations as John Mills and I talk about Star Wars each and every week. But Chris, if people wanted to catch up with you and, you know, see what is happening on the other side of the wormhole with you, where would they find you?
Well, Of course, you can find me on the network doing those shows with you, Matthew. And then other than that, you can find me on social media. I'm on pretty much every platform at this point. My username is the same everywhere. C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. And I'd love to chat with you there about Star Trek or Japan or whatever. Just drop me a line. And if you'd like to help us keep this show and everything else that we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to get involved and support the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And I'd like to send a huge thank you to everyone who's supporting us right now. We would not be here without you. So thank you very, very much. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to jumping into season 2 with you. Hop in the circle and go round and round. And that's going to be a fun ride.
Chris, that sounds great. And until next time, we'll see you then as we gaze into the orb.